My name is Greg Kamrad. I'm an AI educator and I run Data Independent, which helps developers learn how to build their first AI applications. And for my coffee, I just do black coffee. I'm going straight.
Welcome back to the MLOps Community Podcast, everyone. I am your host, Dimitri Oss, and today, what a conversation with Greg, Mr. Data Indie himself. You may know him from his YouTube videos that have helped and inspired thousands of people. Today, I had a blast talking about OpenAI's Dev Day. We brought our own special spin and thoughts to the table. Hopefully, it's something new that you haven't seen from the thousands of different recaps that are out there on the internet. We gave our two cents on what was special and what we thought wasn't so special. And here's a little funny takeaway from that. I thought this AI shield thing was revolutionary. Greg was like, I think it's just marketing, man. So that was a cool one to get into, debate a little bit. We also talked about the context window and how he created a whole special test on where and how valuable each part of the context window is. He gets into how that works, and you can check out a link to his whole video that he created in the description. We talked about how he produces content, how he goes over different pieces of products, because I love his product mindset and what he brings to the table when it comes to creating videos and creating products that he then makes videos out of. For those of you that do not know, Greg advises startups from seed to growth stages, and his whole mission, his objective, we could say, is to cultivate not just awareness, but practical understanding of how to optimally utilize a company's tools. So I hope you enjoy this one. I was recording it in Portugal, having a blast on the coastline right outside of Lisbon when we did this one. And one thing that I gotta say, I love Lisbon. I love Portugal just in general, but I forgot how much I love the Portuguese language. One thing that those of you who speak Portuguese will know, and when you want to say that something is going to happen, like it's a done deal, you say combinado, and it's like it's combined. And for some reason, that just sticks with me. I have a great time when I'm there chatting with all my Portuguese friends and listening to that beautiful language. So without further ado, let's get into it, but not before a quick word from our sponsors. Ever grappled with the heavy lifting of multi-million or even billions scale vector data sets in your AI projects? Well then, meet Milvus, the open source vector database that's not only highly scalable, but is also blazing fast. Ooh, it's so hot. Created by Zillas in 2017, Milvus can effortlessly store, index, and manage over a billion embedding vectors. It's battle-tested by thousands of enterprise users. Milvus is built to power vector similarity search for retrieval augmented generation, product recommender systems, anomaly detection, image similarity applications, and so much more. With 9 specialized index types and GPU acceleration support, Milvus delivers 10x the throughput of other solutions. Ready to find out why Milvus is the most widely adopted open source vector database? Visit milvus.io or get started in seconds with the fully managed free version of Milvus at zilliz.com. That's Z-I-L-L-I-Z.com. Check it out. All the links are in the description. Let's go. We are here with Mr. Data Independent himself, Greg. It is great to have you here, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Demetrius.
It's perfect timing too, and I feel like the stars aligned, because last week we were supposed to do this, but last week the whole AI, OpenAI Dev Day didn't happen yet. So we would have had a conversation. It would have been amazing. I know it would have been, but today it's just like even more topical and more perfect because it just happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I hosted a watch party here in San Francisco, and we had about 100 folks come in and just nerd out on AI stuff, right? So obviously there's huge demand to get into the event, and the event looked freaking awesome. I mean, it wasn't too corporate-y. It was beautiful. Wasn't too much hype. I mean, there was a lot of hype, but like, I think it was justified. But for all the folks that didn't get in, we still wanted a place to nerd out on all this stuff. And so we partnered up with the VC, the GP, and that was over in Jackson Square in San Francisco. And we just had a freaking great time watching it.
Nice. Yeah. Shout out to Finn and everybody at the GP. That's an awesome crew over there. And that sounds like the most San Francisco thing you could do, have a watch party for the OpenAI Dev Day.
Yeah. Well, you know, we weren't the only one either. So there is a couple others that were going on. There's plenty of demand for it. And it was a Monday at 10 a.m. People were working.
Yeah. It was funny because the pictures seemed like the event was way smaller than I was expecting it to be.
The OpenAI, the live dev day?
Yeah, the live
yeah,
event.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you what, the main event looked pretty packed. I couldn't really tell how many were in there. But then all the different workshops and breakouts that they had too seemed really, really cool. I love seeing the screenshots of the slides that were getting poked around.
So we should probably just get into it, man. I mean, you've been creating YouTube videos. You've been doing all kinds of incredible stuff around not only software engineering, but data. Your background's in data. And so the whole LLM revolution caught you in a great place, and the YouTube videos that you created have helped so many of us, myself included, understand what is going on in this space and how to best utilize it. And so you have this unique viewpoint because I feel like you are knee deep in everything that is happening. And like, I consider myself on the cutting edge, but I get the feeling you are even more cutting edge than me watching this stuff as it happens at VC prefers opposite. Oh, so what were some, like, you wrote the Twitter thread just now, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that are probably on your mind. I have some things that are on my mind. What are things that jumped out at you right away?
Sure. You know, I kind of was mentally bucketing them into different categories. The first one I thought was like, kind of like the table stakes, the standard stuff. Sure, GPT-4 is going to be faster. Makes sense. GPT-4 is going to be cheaper. Makes sense. The context length was going to increase. That was pretty cool. I wasn't expecting that to go all the way up to 128K, but I guess if you have Anthropic marketing 100K, then you're definitely going to have to one-up them a little bit. Anyway, so that was all the standard stuff. I wasn't too surprised by any of that. I'm actually doing an analysis that's pressure testing the 128,000 context token limit, and I'm excited to put that out later. But then there's kind of the wild card stuff. And so the things that really interest me were the new modalities. So the text-to-speech API, cool, net new capability. That one's probably my least favorite because we already had 11 labs in PlayHT, so this stuff was already out there. But if you can consolidate vendors and have the OpenAI product quality, sure. That's pretty easy. I like consolidating APIs. And then, of course, there's DALL-E 3, which is net new via the API. It's like, that's really cool. That's a completely new thing. Now, I still think that it's kind of early because we don't have as much control over the generated images as we may want. The spelling isn't right. You can't go edit the thing that's in the top right corner and kind of isolate it as well as I may want it to be. So that one will grow. It's okay. And then before I get to the last one, the things that I think were really, really hyped that I'm still questioning is the GPT assistance. So huge promise, huge hype. I think there's a lot of really cool things that are going on with it. But after the plugin adoption, I'm not 100% confident it's going to be a home run, right? The App Store, I think it could be amazing. I need to see a little bit of proof in the pudding and see some user adoption on that before I go and I say that this is really freaking cool.
And explain the assistance real fast for those who didn't catch the update.
Yeah, so OpenAI, they came out with kind of two things. One is this concept of what they call a GPT. And so the name's a little controversial because GPT means one thing, but they're using it to mean sort of like a bot. You can think of it as a prepackaged chatbot. So all of a sudden, when you create a GPT, you can give it documents, background context. So everybody and their mothers, their first kind of hello world application they would build with language models is they'd create a chatbot and they'd go attach internal company documents, or they'd go attach a website so they can ask questions to a website, or everybody, or I do a lot too, the Paul Graham essays, right? Well, now instead of doing that manually, you can go and do that via no code on the UI. So you can go create a GPT, which is just like a bot. You can attach some files to it. So all of a sudden it can go and do retrieval. So you're going to give it extra context, which is pretty cool. But then not only that, you can also connect different tools to your GPT as well. And the big one that everybody loves right now is the code interpreter. And so the code interpreter from OpenAI, that's when they're going to run a little bit of code on their end to answer your question. So for example, if you gave them a complicated math equation, well, having ChatGPT try to do that in its head, even if you said think out loud, could be pretty tough. It'd be a lot easier if ChatGPT could write the code according to the math equation, run the code, and then get you the answer. And that's what Code Interpreter does, which is really cool. Okay, so then if that's an assistant, it's kind of like an isolated single bot. Well, the next natural thing is let people create bots and then go share them with other people. So they created a marketplace where you can make a bot and then share it with friends. And so, of course, everybody's drawing parallels to the Apple App Store. And so you can see, like, you have a bot logo, you have a bot creator, you have a terms of service and things like that on these bots. And it's like, man, if that takes off, that's pretty cool, because now you have these specialized tools that you can use for different use cases around your workflows. And if that wasn't enough, the part that makes it extremely interesting is they're doing a revenue share with the developers who create these bots. So now all of a sudden you have an incentive to make sure that your bot has a value, or else you're not gonna get paid for it. You have an incentive to market your bot. So we haven't seen any ads yet for like GPTs, but the minute you have a customer acquisition cost and the minute you have a LTV, well, you're gonna see a lot more paid ads for these types of bots that drive you to the OpenAI App Store. I'm very enthusiastic about it, but this is a net new paradigm in the AI world, which is untested. I have no idea if users will naturally gravitate towards these types of use cases. I don't know if it's going to flow, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm optimistic, but I'm cautiously optimistic, which is why I'm not declaring victory on this quite yet. And then the last thing was that I was most excited about from the announcement was GPT-4 vision via API. So a couple of weeks ago, I did a big fat analysis around how people were actually using GPT-4 vision, but it was all one-shot examples because you're just doing it through the AI, through the UI. You give the UI a photo, it gives you a single response back. And that was kind of the end of the workflow. But now we're starting to see different types of apps take advantage of the iterative nature of going back and forth with the AI. So for example, the one that's early on is this dude attaches GPT-4 vision to his webcam. And I think it must just take a photo every 5 seconds or something like that and then go process it. But he'll show different objects in his webcam, and then all of a sudden GPT-4V will tell him what's in the webcam, which is pretty cool.
Nice.
So anyway, that's the one I'm most excited about, but there's a lot of really cool stuff that was announced there.
I have one that a buddy was telling me about just last week too, when it comes to the vision and what he's been trying to do with vision, but it hasn't been as easy because you haven't had that API accessibility until now. But there are companies out there, and this may seem crazy to us technologically advanced species on the planet, but there are companies that still use fax machines, and they've got their fax machine hooked up to, okay, if I get a fax, it gets routed to an email-like inbox. And then from that email-like inbox, I take those faxes that come through, and I have someone on my team take what it is from the fax, and usually it's orders that are coming through, so they get their orders through via fax, and it has all the fields in the fax, and it's like in a PDF.
In it?
And someone from the team has to transfer that data from the PDF to their order form. All of a sudden now this guy was like, you know what we can do? We can just throw that PDF into ChatGPT
and I love it.
Spit out a CSV file. And so at the end of the day, you can just batch it, throw all of those PDFs into it, and then spit out one long CSV, and there's your order form now.
I absolutely love it. And we don't yet have access to GPT-4V fine-tuning. And so it's only going to get better from here. But I think that's an absolutely beautiful use case.
Yeah. And it's one of those ones where you're like, wow, if you just understand what is possible right now, you don't have to make those big swings. It's just there are people that are doing things that are so painful that they do not need to be doing. And if you just understand what you can do, and it, and 99% of the time, let's be honest, it's probably like good enough with a Zapier integration.
Sure.
And it's just, if you know how to automate it, then you provide so much value to that company. But there are these times where you're like, oh, yeah, you could throw this into GPT or whatever your LLM of choice is, or whatever, if it's just a clip and interrogator XYZ, you can throw it in there and do some really useful stuff out of it. And all of a sudden, it frees up that person's time to do, hopefully, higher value work.
Yeah. I totally agree. The hard part with all those things is usually just finding the problem that's actually there and actually validated, and then finding somebody to pay for that problem. Once you do that, like you said, I totally agree. The barrier to building is pretty low right now. So it's just about finding the problems and the customers.
Yeah. And it's like, go into these different places where people are curious about AI, but they don't understand AI, and they've got their business, and they're probably a little bit like, they're just worrying about their business in the day to day. And so they can't go and explore what is possible with AI, but they're like, I'm hearing about AI. What can we do? And you just got to be like, what are some processes that you're doing? Tell me about your business, you know?
Totally.
I feel like that is something that you have a nice vantage point on, because you do understand all these possibilities. And then when you talk to people that are doing things, you can say, okay, this could totally be fixed with software, right? And I'm not going out on a limb and saying that software can fix everything, but I do see that there are a lot of things out there that now, because of the capabilities that we have, they can be updated for this new paradigm, we could say.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. My background is really on the B2B products and like operations side of the house. So I've done a lot of building my own tools. And I've done a lot of trying to dig into customers and figure out what product do we build, how do we iterate towards PMF, and all of those hard problems, and like gone through the muck to do it. And so it's really fascinating for me as a student of building products to look at the landscape right now and see all the products that are now unlocked, and then all the problems that those products could be applied to.
Yeah, totally. I mean, going back to this, the announcements, I really like that you didn't declare a victory on the App Store idea yet. It feels like that needs to happen. I just wonder if OpenAI is going to be the winner there, or if it's going to be like a more generalized version where you have that marketplace, but it's using a little bit. Because I just foresee that you're going to have some really cool, whatever you want to call them, GPTs or assistants or whatever, you're going to have those, but a lot of them are going to be quite complex pipelines.
First.
And I'm not sure that within or using GPT 3 or 4 or whatever, you're going to get everything that you want. And maybe you will be able to. You drink the Kool-Aid and you go, you know what? I got fine tuning. I've got GPT-4. It's the best that there is.
Sure.
And I'm just going to go for it. But you also have to deal with, like, they kind of take a lot of the pie, right? It's like, I think the commission or the payout is like, there's a lot left to be desired. I don't think they announced all of it, but it's the same as like when you're dealing with the Apple App Store, right? And you got to pay out 30% because people buy something on the App Store. But the thing with the App Store is that everybody's got an iPhone, and so you're kind of constrained to it. I don't see it as like, oh, everybody's got to use GPT or OpenAI as of yet. Maybe they will, but what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, totally. I think that's a good thought, because I was thinking the same thing. If you compare it to the Apple App Store, why was the App Store so successful? Well, at the beginning, it kind of wasn't. They needed to pour a lot of money into it to get people to build, to do the curation, right? But the difference between the Apple App Store and the GPT Store is the App Store was constrained to the iPhone. The iPhone's a piece of hardware. Once people bought the phone, it was very hard to switch off the phone. So you got the apps in the first place. But then not only that, the apps kind of sold the iPhone, because Apple would promote the app, which would then go and promote the phone, and then they would just help each other out, right? Which is pretty cool. So if you were to look at that analogy and compare it to Google, Anthropic, OpenAI, you know, Meta, and all these groups, you know, a couple weeks ago, you could say that the model was the equivalent of the phone. But especially with tools like LangChain, you can switch models extremely easy. You can even host your own freaking model on your local, and it's only going to get easier to do that. Okay, so there's not much lock-in or defensibility on just the model piece other than generalized intelligence, cost, latency, et cetera, et cetera. But those things you can work around. So the part that's interesting about the move with OpenAI is how they're choosing to build lock-in with developers and with functionality. So it's not a mistake, or it's not a coincidence that they're hosting your files for you.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a coincidence that they're running code interpreter code for you. Because that's the more you build on top of that is the more lock-in as a developer you're building, that's going to be harder to do for Google. And that's what's so fascinating about thinking about this AI race is if developers get used to perfect JSON output from OpenAI, function calling from OpenAI, code interpreter from OpenAI, what is the response going to be from an Anthropic and a Google? Do they have to build those to have table stakes? I don't know. Do they go and do something better? I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be weird if you can't output JSON all the time, right? Like, as a developer, you're not going to put up with it because you have been getting it perfectly with this other tool. So it is, yeah, it does feel like it quickly becomes table stakes.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned the model and the lock-in. They are just eating, like, the surface area that they're eating up and the way that they're growing and going more and more, like expanding more and more, is an interesting one to watch, because it had already felt like, wow, they were a monopoly. And now it's just like, and now they're eating up, they're trying to like grow and grow and grow. And so I wonder about that, because there's a lot of surface area that they're trying to cover. And is it going to be like the first generation data tooling that came out in whatever 2015, 2016, or even before that, like the Domino Data Labs,
mm-hmm.
where they're platform and they kind of do everything, but they don't do things as like machine learning moved on. It was like, well, this isn't really what I'm looking for in my machine learning playbook anymore, right?
Yeah,
but they captured a lot of that initial market that was doing stuff because they were the platform in the beginning. So it feels like a little bit of that play, but considering how much surface area they have and they're taking up, you can't do all of it well, right? Like, or I mean, maybe you can, but it just feels like it's a much harder play.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on that note, they are definitely increasing their product surface area, that's for sure. And you need, if you want to keep the quality bar, you need people who can think about how to keep that quality bar. I'm pretty sure they've increased their headcount size. You know, I'd have to look up exactly how much they have right now, but I mean, it's absolutely massive. I think there were 300 and now they're like 700.
They're growing quick.
Yeah, they're growing quick. And so it looks like this is 200 to 500 employees on LinkedIn still, which seems a little small, but maybe not. But yeah. And, you know, I bet OpenAI wants Google to do something, because OpenAI, they want the spotlight, but they don't want to be the freaking 98% market share type of spotlight. They want Google to come in and go do something with them. So I think another interesting question, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this too. You know, part of, in the back of my mind, I mean, I'm fine with Google. Some people hate Google. I'm fine with it. I'm rooting for them. You know, I'm a capitalist at heart, and so I love to see companies compete for value against consumers. I thought Google was just slow for a little bit, and I was like, oh, they'll get their act together. They'll come out with something. But when you see something like Dev Day from OpenAI, and then you saw the Suhail's tweet that was where period is period Google period.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, is there an actual problem that we're not seeing good product and good innovation coming out for them? Or is it just, no, they haven't pulled the trigger yet? What do you think?
I mean, from what I've heard from friends that work there is that they are a little bit more secretive about what they're doing, right? And I think it feels like it's twofold. One is that they're trying to build in AI to the products that they already have, as opposed to go and create an AI product, like a new sure. AI product.
Sure.
And so that feels like kind of weird, though, because Google, when I was growing up, Google was all about the moonshots. And, you know, you had, what was it, like Google X or something? Google, what was the moonshot one that they had?
Yeah.
I heard, and this is all hearsay, and I don't know, a friend of mine told me who worked there,
sure.
uh-huh. works there. He was like, the vibe that he got with the researchers, the ML researchers at Google, is that they were very open when it came to putting out all these papers and putting out all of this information on this research that they were doing. And then they put it out there only for others to capitalize on it.
Yeah.
So now they're not as interested in putting it out there, right?
sure. Yeah. I wonder if it's the researchers who thought that, or if it's the suits running Google that think that. But
yeah, probably a little bit of both.
But either way, I tell you what, I'm rooting for them. As a consumer, I love companies battling for value, and so I hope it works, whatever it is.
Yeah, you know, one thing that came out of this dev day that I thought was probably for me the most interesting that I didn't see coming at all was the shield and being able to protect you against copyright.
Yeah. You know, I made my top 10 list, and I actually left that one off the top 10. And I had a few.
Oh, really? That was my number one. That was off of your top 10 completely.
Well, I tell you why. Because, I mean, it kind of seems like more of a marketing play than anything, because they need to reinforce the message. Or I guess what I heard from somebody who was familiar with it was that from a sales standpoint, companies were worried that they would get sued for using OpenAI because of people who claim copyright material on there. Now, just like how OpenAI says, we do not train on anything that comes through the API or ChatGPT Enterprise, I think it was just more of a marketing play. Because, like, what did they actually say? They said, like, oh, we'll help you with legal and pay your costs if it comes in. But, like, it felt a little fuzzy with that.
Oh, really?
But then on the other hand, I thought, well, if you're OpenAI and you have a legal team of 20 people whose specialty expertise 100% is to grind on copyright law, then you're basically kind of just like outsourcing your legal team on who specializes in copyright law. And I don't know if you're going to win against that type of team if they do it over and over and over again. So I think it was more marketing, but who knows?
Yeah, it's funny to think about. I guess it just is very much marketing to make people feel comfortable using the output in their tools, right? And allowing whatever comes out to be okay. And now that you say it like that, I can see that point. I can 100% see. It's just like, yeah, this class action lawsuit, our lawyers will handle that. You don't have to handle it. We'll take care of it for you.
Yeah.
I see that point for sure. I mean, one other piece that I wanted to talk to you about was when it came to the orchestration layer and the LangChains and the Llama Index out there. I'm not sure if you saw Jerry, community member, creator of Llama Index, he threw out that tweet like, people are asking if we still need a tool like Llama Index now that OpenAI released everything. And I thought it was quite thoughtful how he put it out. But it is, you could feel that there's like a bit of existential crisis. Like, oh, well, I guess if OpenAI does this all for us, we no longer need Llama Index to do any of it for us, right? How do you feel about that whole situation?
Yeah. You know, first thing I'll say is when plugins came out, people were flooding my DMs with, is LangChain dead?
It's done all right since then.
It's done just fine. I mean, it's freaking boom since then. I agree with Jerry. And so anybody who's worried about it, I would turn to that person and say, okay, so you want OpenAI to do retrieval on your docs. Oh, cool. What's the retrieval method they're doing? And as far as I've seen, I've seen speculation. I haven't seen any like concrete facts about how they're actually doing retrieval. And then I'd say, oh, cool. Is that method optimized for your vertical and your use case? Oh, well, if you don't know, well, wouldn't you want more control over it? So that's my kind of sassy way of saying that my expectation is that devs will want more control over the retrieval process than OpenAI will give them. And while they probably have a really good retrieval, they have to have a generalized retrieval service, which they have to try to make everybody happy, which is really tough.
Yeah. Hey everyone, my name is Aparna, founder of Arise, and the best way to stay up to date with MLOps is by subscribing to this podcast.
So my hypothesis is that for no code builders, for people who are going to the UI and like building these GPTs, sure, yeah, throw some of your PDFs in there, throw your employee handbook, all that. I'm sure it'll be fine for those use cases. But when you're building a specialized tool, I don't think that you're going to want to rely on OpenAI to control the quality of your retrieval because there's just too much to tune for your specific use cases. So I'm in Jerry's camp. I believe it. I think that the LangChains and Llama Indexes, retrieval-wise, will still be there.
Have you played around with this one? I just know because I interviewed the creator. This is a bit of a tangent, so forgive me. DSPy. Have you played around with DSPy at all?
I haven't heard of it.
No? Dude, I think you're going to like it. So that's just a little bit like put a fork in that one. Go check it out. Have some fun. Make some YouTube videos with it. The idea of compilers just had me literally like, I'm still thinking about it. And I talked to the creator, I think, 3 weeks ago now.
Nice.
So, yeah, I'm a huge fan. It's very much in that orchestration layer and playing around, but the abstraction is quite nice, and the compilers are something that I hadn't thought about, and it reminds me of, I've been watching a little bit of that series Loki. I don't know if you know that series. So they have this like one timeline, which is like the sacred timeline, and then there's like life that is being lived on that timeline, but then you have like these infinite other number of timelines that are branching out of this one timeline. And so the compiler, in my mind, I like envision it like this, because they're trying to do, it says basically, it's like, hey, there's this one way to do this thing, but let's test all these other ways to do this thing, and whichever one we find is the optimal solution. So maybe that comes with prompts. Or maybe that comes with, like, you gave us this prompt or these different functions, and we're going to see if we can find better ways for this to get the output that you're looking for.
Yeah.
And that's one way of doing it. I'm probably, like, chopping it up a little bit, and I may not be, like I said, it was a few weeks ago that I talked to him, I walked away from that conversation blown away.
Yeah, that's absolutely cool. You know, it reminds me of, I'm a big David Deutsch fan, and he says the way that progress gets forward is you make your hypothesis and then you put it up to criticism. And if it can go past that criticism, then you're good to go. So much like you're saying, you make all your different hypotheses, which are trials as to what you think would improve your thing, put it up against the test, which is evals, the criticism, and see which one pops out the other end.
Yeah. Dude, so... yeah, check it out. I mean, back to this, the orchestration layer not being dead.
Yeah.
And this whole idea, I think the other thing that Jerry said that I'm 100% on board with, and you can see the clear trend happening, you mentioned it earlier, models are getting smaller and it's getting easier to run them locally or at least like semi-locally. And I get the feeling that that's going to be a huge value add because now you have control of the model, right? It's like full circle. Like we went really big. First we started small, then we went as big as we could go, and now we're like, wait, actually it might be better small.
Yeah, totally. You know, I think I measure it in terms of this is kind of like the corporate way to say it, but like new workflows that are unlocked. So what I mean by that is, could I have a language model on my iPhone right now? Sure. Yeah, totally. It'd be really small. It wouldn't really do much either because it couldn't do anything. So it's not very useful to me. But I think one of the milestones on a B2C level is, at what level can you have an actual conversation with a language model on your local phone? Well, you need the latency to go down. You need a pretty good model so it has some personality that comes along with it, right? That feels like a really good milestone for that. But then, okay, that milestone kind of stays locked in place. You may want to ask more questions, et cetera, but the problem or the wrinkle with all this is, yes, models will get local, but my hypothesis is that we'll never be done with getting better and better models on our phone. Just like how operating systems get better, they've been getting better ever since the first iPhone. Well, why do they need to get better? Well, we have more photos. We have apps that require more OS, you know, compute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we used to be able to take a photo on our phones, you know, 15 years ago. That functionality still stays the same. It's just gotten a little bit better. That's one of those milestones. But now we have more complex apps and all this other stuff. And so that's kind of a long-winded way of saying we will get local models, but just how OSs progressively get better and better, we won't ever be done and we'll always need new models.
Yeah, they'll continually get better and better. And then the real interesting piece is like, how does your personalized model fit into that? Or how does, is one model or two models? Like, I have no idea what the future looks like with these models or what the use cases are and these workflows that you're unlocking, as you said, because it's like, for me, I'm trying to figure out what exactly does it mean, but I'm also trying to keep my feet on the ground and not be like, AI is going to change everything.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, it's funny you bring up the one model, two models, three models or whatever. Let's use the GPTs as an example. Let's just make the assumption that they're all powered off of GPT-4, the new preview version. Well, that's just one model. So what's different about them? Well, how they're configured is different. So the files that they have, the prompt that they have, the tools that they have access to. And so while it may seem like multiple personalities and multiple models, nah, it's just one model with a bunch of different configs stacked on top of it. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the paradigm that we see as well. It could just be low number of models. You really don't need that many. You just need the config on top of it to change.
Yeah. So how do you look at, because you've seen all kinds of cool apps, and I feel like you play a lot in the application layer, right?
Yeah, that's what I like.
A lot of times on this podcast, we'll talk about the infrastructure, and we'll talk about even like a little bit deeper, like what is OpenAI using to create the GPTs, right? But then you can go up the stack a little bit and say, okay, now that we've got these LLMs, and we've got the stack that we're using these LLMs for, there's an application that comes and serves the end user.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like you've got a great lay of the land of that landscape and also an understanding of like how to make an application that is built with AI defensible if we are in one way or another using the same models, using the same orchestration frameworks, we've all got access to kind of the same tools.
Yeah.
So then it's like the special sauce is what? And I understand that an easy answer for that is like, oh, well, the special sauce is the prompts. But that just doesn't feel like it's defensible, right? Like,
sure.
And especially with, once you dig into DSPI, I think you'll see why. And one thing that Omar, the creator of that, was talking about is how wrong we are to assume like the best way of creating apps is like prompting first. And so anyway, that's just a long-winded question on like, how can we look at defensibility?
Yeah, totally. You know, to answer your first question very briefly, like, it's all about finding customer problems. Like I said earlier in the pod, you got to find customer problems and you got to find people to go pay for those problems. If you can't do that, then it's going to be really tough to build out your app in the first place. And builders have a romantic idea that if you build it, they will come. But it like, there's no one way to get success. The other quote that I love, I heard it on My First Million, was that if you follow Warren Buffett's rules, you'll never be Peter Thiel. If you follow Peter Thiel's rules, you'll never be Warren Buffett. Right? And so what I'm the reason why I say that is because advice is grayscale and go-to-market is grayscale. So there's a million ways to create products, but the common thread against products that are successful that I've seen is they all start with a customer problem. It's like the Y Combinator, Axiom, make something people want, and how Paul Graham also emphasizes, make a small group of people love your product, then a big group of people just like your product, right? So that's number one. Then when we talk about defensibility, the essay that I always reference, and I try to read it like almost every 6 months at this point, is Elad Gil's essay on defensibility. And the TLDR of it is, for the things that make an AI app defensible are the same things that make a foundational traditional business defensible, right? And so you're going to have your network effects. Can you build those in? Your platform effects, your sales and your distribution, your partnerships, your brand, you know, all of that. Now, it's funny that you bring up the prompt thing, because it's like, oh, are prompts defensible? Well, that's just one way. That's just a form of tech intellectual property, right? And so how long will it take for somebody to figure out your prompts? Well, maybe not too long. All right, so that's not too defensible. You may have like a couple weeks head start on people for that. So the only difference in the AI world is that the barrier to the tech aspect of defensibility is dropping. And so you really want to look towards other mediums of your defensibility in order to really build it up from there. And, you know, a very correlated question that's super hot right now is, what's everybody's opinion on ChatGPT wrappers? Oh, it's just a wrapper. You know, it doesn't do much. It's not defensible. It's a bad business. My view on it is, well, customer energy is customer energy. Customer energy is one of the hardest things to get when building a product. If you build a wrapper that's a simple, simple, simple wrapper, and you get a million users overnight, I don't care at all. I think, holy cow, you have lightning in a bottle. Now go do your work as a good business person to go capture that and go make it more defensible. But if you told me, do I want a defensible business with no users, or do I want an undefensible business with a million users that I can go iterate on? I'm picking the latter all day long, for sure.
That is a great answer, and that it makes me want to go in so many directions, but I love this idea of how, yeah, you got to figure it out first. You got to figure out what people want and what they're actually willing to pay for, right? And then if it's not defensible, it reminds me a little bit of the craze with the fine tuning on the image generation. Uh-huh. Like when Stable Diffusion came out, then all of a sudden you had everyone able to make their own selfie. And yeah. Some people yeah. were going and they were fine tuning their own Stable Diffusion model. Others were going and just using Lensa or like photo profile, AI photo, oh. whatever pick. And you had 20 of those come out. And I heard a stat at one point that like Lensa was making 6 million. They made 6 million in profit or something like that. So the thought that I had was, and what I've talked to people about is how, yeah, there probably are a lot of really obvious use cases, and those are the ones that you are going to have a harder time defending against, sure. right? So like a photo generator, a selfie photo generator is a quite obvious use case. And then, but then there's use cases where you go deep into a certain field and you recognize that you can use AI for this. Like maybe it is a dentist that now can create the ideal looking facial or teeth structure because Stable Diffusion is fine tuned on like perfect teeth. I don't know. I'm making shit up now. What I'm getting at is that there is like this long tail of use cases that are so niche that you have open area. It's totally greenfield, right?
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I think that there's power in niching down, because then not only is the opportunity less attractive for big businesses because the TAM isn't there for them, but the opportunity is still attractive to indie builders and small businesses because there's enough for there. I mean, is Google going to go after an opportunity that's, you know, $1 million a year? I mean, probably not. It's not high on their priority list. But is an indie dev going to go after that? Heck yeah, they will. And so I think that niching down is completely a wonderful idea. I love it. And I'm sure Paul Graham has some good quotes around niching down, but they're not coming to mind right now.
Yeah, that's the, oh man, that's great how you reference it. You've been playing around with Paul Graham as your like lorem ipsum for so many different tools that you build that you just have them ingrained in your head. Oh, that was essay number 5. I remember that one.
It's true. I mean, it's there. That's what I use for like a lot of my like background context. And so like I was like essays memorized in my head and which one's a short one and which one's his longest one for all that stuff.
Again, like that is the most San Francisco thing that you could be telling me right now on this call. It is so good.
I was at my high school reunion a little while ago and I was talking to this girl and she said, what do you do? I said, oh, I work at Salesforce. She goes, oh, so you're a tech boy. You're just a tech boy. And, you know, she said it in a derogatory term, whatever. But you know what? It's really good if you can have self-awareness and you know yourself. And you know what, Demetrios? I'm a tech boy. And I don't give a shit because I like it. It's what I like. It's what I'm passionate about.
Own it.
I like doing it. So I'm a freaking own it.
Exactly, yeah. Man. There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
You have been making some really cool videos when it comes to, and it's not only around LLMs, and you're bringing different modalities into the mix, right? So you think it's almost like three-dimensional where you're like, okay, well, we have image generators can do this, LLMs can do this, and then we have audio to text, and then we have text to audio. So and you're able to come back to thinking about product in that way. And there's one that I know that we had talked about for, I think you were doing something where it was with startup pitches, where you record the startup pitches.
Yeah.
You get a bunch of information. Can you explain that? Because I thought that was really innovative. And the way that you come up with these different ideas is super cool because you're doing it. I mean, you have these products, but you're not really taking them to market. You're just showing other people how to do this and learn from it, right?
Totally. So I was really into the idea of using a language model, but for a live event, right? And so I was really trying to think about where could I bring this for a live event? And it was kind of like the wearable trend that just came out with a Rewind and Tab, where you're going to wear the pendant around your neck and it's going to like listen and stuff like that. I thought, you know, I want to do one of those, but I want to do it for a niche topic. So I don't need it to follow me around my entire life, just this one specific instance. And I was thinking about, where am I going to do this? Where am I going to do this? And then I had the idea, oh, that'd be kind of cool if I did it as if I was an investor listening to a startup's pitch. So what I would do is I would record the startup's pitch on my phone. I'd click record or whatever. It'd have the audio, get the transcription using one of my favorite transcription tools, Deepgram. And then I would take that, give it to a language model. And then step one is just like, oh, analyze it and summarize it for me. Okay, that's all the easy stuff. But step two is like, oh, well, no, go connect this to the outside world. So go get news about the industry that startup is in that may be relevant to what the pitch is telling you about. Give me follow-up questions that would poke holes within the startup's pitch that may be pertinent for me to ask about. And so then all of a sudden I'm like, holy cow, now I could have an intelligent companion for me for startup pitches. And I could ask questions that I would have never like remembered off the top of my head. And it might've been rude to go look up or whatever. And so I'm currently in the process of building that. And believe it or not, the biggest blocker for that is I can't find many startup pitches out there that aren't Web3. And I don't really want to go to a Web3 startup pitch. And so I'm looking for more events to try to go to and test this out on.
That's where I have like a pattern interrupt, because I'm like, the amount of companies I feel like that are raising in the AI space, I thought it would be like shooting fish out of a barrel, man.
I think those are all happening behind doors and like in VC's offices. I haven't seen a lot of events where I need the one where there's an intimate setting, the startup gives its pitch, and the audience can ask some questions. And so I'm still in the hunt for that one.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Yeah, all these AI companies are just getting funded after the first VC meeting.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just going, here, what was the valuation? 100 million? All right, no product, no revenue, no traction. Take my money.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I realized that it was really in the smart companion app for a live event, I thought, oh, well, actually, there's a bunch of these. What about a lecture at your university? That's pretty cool to have like a little companion that's like live annotating the lecture and giving you supplemental information. Okay. And of course, you know, there's that tweet that went viral around the guy who was using it for a job interview. You know, the interviewer would ask a question and then the GPT would tell him the answers on what to ask for. It's like, okay, that's kind of interesting. And like, there's really kind of a lot, like this would never work, but like there's a lot of first dates that people go on, and a lot of dates they need a companion on like things to ask and how to go well on that. There's the school aspect. There's the startup pitches. There's sales for sure. In-person sales is huge. There's conference, you know, you're at a booth and you're talking to a customer, you know, just a bajillion things where it helped to have a live companion. So I think that's kind of cool.
So now you realize that it's like, take me through the whole idea from idea to then productizing it to then, oh, actually, this is bigger than just a startup pitch companion.
Yeah. The place where it usually starts is I get the original idea, which again, we talk about going niche. Well, startup pitches, niche. Okay, cool. And then I was building the MVP. So go record the audio. Okay, now take that audio, get the transcription, go pass it to the language model. And then it's like, oh, well, at the language model, you need questions, you need news, you need follow-ups, you need go, can you find out who the founders are and what their backgrounds are so you have it immediately on there, you know? And then it's like, wait a minute. This is kind of cool. Let me put this out there. Because luckily, one of the nice things about having a little bit of a Twitter following is you can pressure test ideas pretty easily. You just throw it out there and see what the reaction is. If that reaction motivates you enough, cool. Well, how would you generalize this? Because really, like you said, at the end of the day, it's a bunch of prompts. It's a bunch of retrieval. And so it's not that hard to generalize these things. You know, especially, I haven't explored it too much, but even with the GPTs that are coming around, they have access to the web. Can you use them to go do a lot of this stuff? Who knows?
Have you thought about, are you going to try and create a GPT?
Oh yeah, for sure. I'll mess around with it. I'll play with it. You know, if GPTs work, there's a paradigm for where you run an agency that only creates and maintains GPTs. Sure. Like that's a playbook that's out there. We've seen it with the App Store. We've seen it happen many times. That will happen with a GPT store, right? Is that an attractive model? I mean, it sounds kind of fun because you're basically like a GPT studio and you're just creating these things and finding what's going to have value and, you know, reaping in the benefits from there. From a testing standpoint, 100%. I mean, if you're playing in this game, you got to go try it out and you got to see it.
How you think through the product is fascinating to me. And then being able to make content out of it and recognize like, oh, here I should probably see, am I on track? Let's ask the internet and put yourself out there. I think is a huge, it's a little bit courageous on one hand, and it's also really cool to see and watch how you can come up with these different ideas and then you create them. And so I am 100% excited about that video when it comes out and other videos. I mean, I know you told me a little bit about the video that you're creating with the new OpenAI updates. I don't know if you can tell everyone. This will go out next week, I guess, this podcast. So
nice.
Maybe your video's already out by then.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. I'm not used to talking in the future like that, but you're right. So 128,000 context token limit. I mean, that sounds pretty cool, right? But the number one question that everybody has is, how is retrieval? Is it going to work still? Is it not going to work? And so I'm doing what I'm calling a needle in a haystack analysis. And what that means is I have just a single sentence that is that has a fact in it. And the fact is just a playful one. It said, the best thing to do in San Francisco is go to Dolores Park and eat a sandwich on a sunny day. I've done it many times. Go get an Ike's sandwich and go sit in the park. It's beautiful. And so what I do is I stick that single fact somewhere in the middle of 120,000 tokens worth of context. And then I give that to ChatGPT and I say, hey, what's the best thing to do in San Francisco based on the context up above? And I see if it can pull it out, right? So that answer is yes or no, and it's not very exciting. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to do it at various context lengths. So 1,000 tokens worth of context, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, and do it iteratively across the whole thing, all up to 128 to see if it could do it or not. Okay, cool. That's another good step. But being the data person, I have a heat map in my head. And so yeah. Then I thought, well, the other thing that people talk about all the time is the position in the document in which the fact is held. And so then I was like, all right, well, let me make this a 2D axis and let me actually put the fact at the very top, 10% the way down, 20% the way down, 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%, et cetera. And let me see how it does with retrieval at various context lengths and various document depths. And let me go see what it is. And I just spent like freaking $200 worth of GPT-4 Pro API costs to go run this. But
they gotta be sponsoring you by now. This is crazy. This is absolutely nuts.
I should have really got a sponsor for like $1,500 and just went freaking crazy on this, yeah. But I didn't. But anyway, I have the results and they're pretty interesting, actually. I'm not going to spoil them right now. You'll have to go find me on Twitter, find me on YouTube.
Exactly. We'll drop the link to that video in the description for anybody that wants to know. My biggest question is, have you also done it with Anthropic?
That's a great question. No, I haven't. But I mean, all these are just parameters. And so I could just throw it into Anthropic and we'll see what it is.
Yeah, exactly. And then compare the two and see which one is better.
One of my pet peeves about this entire industry is the lack of digestible benchmarks. It just drives me nuts. Because AI used to be just all academics, right? And they're used to these random ass papers in black and white that are on archive or whatever. Well, with all the business people and all the laymans and all the normies like myself that are now in the industry, like getting further, I need something simple. I want freaking modelbenchmarks.com and go give me exactly what I want to see updated daily. And I don't have that yet. And if I saw a way to monetize that a little bit more, I may go after it myself, but I don't yet.
Is that domain free?
I looked it up. I wouldn't say that domain unless it was free, and it's not.
Oh, man. Who's got that domain? Modelbenchmarks.com. Show yourself and give it to the people so that we can do that. That is so good. And I feel for you, man. I 100% understand what you're saying. I almost look at this this idea of being able to grab the proof. And again, little tangent, but I was biting my lip not to crack a San Francisco joke in there on the fact that you're asking for.
That's a good point. That is a good point.
And then I was also, you didn't tell what the other text was that wasn't the fact that they were looking for, but I mean.
Yeah. I mean, well, so where am I going to get 128,000 tokens worth of good stuff that's like random? Well, duh. Well, Graham has 118 essays, and so I use all of his essays as the background context.
Of course, man. I love it. It's so perfect. So the thing that I was thinking about is that this feels like it is a new type of benchmark, right? It's not like the benchmarks that you see or the evaluation benchmarks that you see necessarily. Like, hey, how's the output? It feels like there's this whole new content. It's, I don't know what you want to call it. Yeah, context window benchmarking and how well the context window holds up, right?
Yeah.
And there might be something there that could actually be a useful tool for people to have as they're testing out their different use cases. And if whatever the tool is, like, if you know that you're going to get a higher hit rate if the fact is in a certain part of the context window, then you're going to want to manipulate your text or your prompts or whatever it may be so that it coincides with that, right?
Yeah, potentially. You know, and this is a little bit of a hot take here, but if you're passing 128,000 tokens worth of context to GPT-4, you're being a little lazy. And what I mean by that is you got to go do better retrieval. Who in their right mind needs to pass that much because they have that much uncertainty as to where the right thing is? Now, I know you can do it for summarization, but like, come on, that's a lot of context.
Yeah, we don't need to summarize Moby Dick.
No, that's 130 pages. Like, that's 100 freaking, I think they might even said 300 pages worth of stuff. Who's just doing that?
Oh my God.
If you want to rag on me for San Francisco, I mean, even the fact that we're laughing at that is just, that's tech boy stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, as we were talking, I went and I looked up modelbenchmarks.com and actually was free. So I just got it actually. So
no.
We have it.
No, you bought it? Oh,
we have it.
Oh, that's awesome.
We can collaborate on that.
That is incredible. I love it. Yeah. And the best, I really feel like that was something I was hoping Hugging Face would do better, but it feels like Hugging Face didn't really. The leaderboard and just what you get on Hugging Face isn't super clear. And maybe it's because there's just so much material out there and there's so many new models that are coming out. But it would be incredible if it's like, oh, hey, XYZ super niche thing, here's the model for that. And there was a consensus. I guess it's really hard to do, though, to have everyone agree that this is the model for
that. That also, there's a few things. You have to agree on what the version of the model is that you're running. And then two, you have to agree on the benchmark that's being used. There's a bunch of benchmarks out there, and everybody wants to claim that they have the right benchmark. So, but I think it's a problem worth investigating. And then, sure, you have a nice, beautiful UI that's on the website. But then if you apply that to, if you give that via API, maybe there's some dynamic reasoning that you're doing based off of what's trending well right now. I have no idea. I should have built it out first without the domain, but who knows?
We're shooting from the hip here, man. This is a new video idea.
Exactly.
I love this idea. Because, yeah, you can make, there is, have you heard the idea around the AI gateway? And like having some kind of proxy that will route your prompts or whatever it may be, like your API calls to the right model or to the right, it might not even be a model that's needed, right? Depending on the call. And so you have something that is a gateway and it can say, oh, hey, well, I see this prompt. And because I noticed that this prompt is dealing with some kind of legal jargon, we're going to route it to the fine-tuned legal LLM. Or I see this prompt. I don't really understand what it is. Let's just throw it at GPT-4 and have it.
Yeah. It makes sense to me. I mean, that's a routing question. And yeah. I don't see, we haven't yet gotten to the world where my hypothesis is we'll go this way, where there's small fine-tuned models for niche use cases. I think the world's going that direction.
Yeah.
We haven't yet. I haven't seen that in wide practice quite yet. Everybody has their own internal models. In fact, I think that's going to be a big thing that we didn't hear from OpenAI Dev Day that I think we'll hear next year is, or at least by next year, is you don't have the ability yet to power a GPT by a fine-tuned model. I think that is going to be really, really cool because you'll be able to get extra performance out of your GPT. Because right now you can just pick like, you know, GPT 3.5 or 4 or whatever. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I thought, I didn't realize that they didn't announce that. I thought that was just kind of like inherent because it feels like you're going to be able to get so much more out of it if you can have a fine tune and your own special, like you add your special sauce to this fine tuned one and then you throw that on the marketplace.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think that, we will see that for sure. And I think that the marketplace for those fine-tuned models will be extra good. So, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it, man. I appreciate you coming on here. This is awesome. I love talking to you, as always. And encourage everyone to go and check out the video to see where the best place to put the truth is in your context window. That's so good. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on, and I'm a big fan of the MLOps community, so thanks for everything that you do there.
This is Skyler. I lead machine learning at Health Rhythms. If you want to stay on top of everything happening in MLOps, subscribe to this podcast now. 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 Now.